Washing your dishes before you wash your dishes? Dirty Labs believes going green in the kitchen should not mean doing extra work. Their bioenzyme dishwasher detergent cuts through stuck on food and leaves dishes sparkling, without compromising on safety or performance. No pre-rinse, no post-rinse, no compromise. Just powerful cleaning made without harsh chemicals. If Dirty Labs can't make you believe in the power of green cleaning, nothing will. Fall in love, or it's free, at dirtylabs.com.
Hey, this is Richard Deitch, the host of the Sports Media Podcast. If you're interested in what's happening with all the places where you consume sports, the Sports Media Podcast has you covered.
I've been turning down interviews all week. Hoda Kotb reached out, Oprah, George Stephanopoulos. So I said no. I was booked on the Deitch Podcast before the Taylor Swift phenomenon. I must live up to my responsibility.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I have something to say that I'm not sure many people are going to agree with. I'll just start with that. After hours here on 96.5 The Fan, Logan Weber alongside Jacob Mustard. And what I'm talking about is in reference to the MLB All-Star Game. Specifically, the voting. And more specific than that, fan voting. I am a baseball fan. I am a basketball fan. I'm a sports fan, obviously. I wouldn't be in this business doing what I'm doing if I wasn't. And every year, I vote. I put myself in there, right? And I become a part of the All-Star voting as a fan, as many of us do. And I understand the desire from professional sports leagues to do that because you're trying to get more fan involvement in something like that, right? It makes them feel more attached to the game. Giving them an input, I feel like, is important in some sense. But when it starts to become foolish, I feel like we need to reevaluate. And I would gladly give up my ability as a fan to vote on the All-Star game if it meant giving more credence to players who are deserving of All-Star voting instead of what it has inevitably become across many sports. Just a popularity contest. Let me just run this down for you for a brief moment. Phase one of All-Star voting has now come and gone. Excuse me. And here's how it shakes out. At the end of phase one, Vladimir Guerrero is the All-Star vote leader at first base in the American League. Vladimir Guerrero, who is hitting .279 this season with 10 home runs and 39 RBIs. Now, his on-base percentage is incredibly impressive, a .383. He's only got two more strikeouts to walks right now, 45 walks, 47 Ks. So that, I mean, that's great. But if that's what we're looking at, Jonathan Aranda of the Tampa Bay Rays right now is fourth in Major League Baseball in batting average. He's hitting .325. He's got eight home runs, which is only two less than Vladimir Guerrero. Aranda has two more RBIs. Yet, Jonathan Aranda is third in the American League in voting for first base. Guy's hitting .325. He's fourth in Major League Baseball in batting average, third in the voting at his own position. What? And just to extend my point even further, he's fourth in Major League Baseball in batting average. The other three guys are not first basemen in the American League. Don't understand how that works. Spencer Torkelson, who is hitting a very lowly .223, but has the most home runs and RBIs of any first baseman in the American League with 16 long balls, 49 ribbies, and a .330 on base percentage. He's fourth in the All-Star voting, behind Aranda, Paul Goldschmidt, who's in second, and Vladimir Guerrero. Now, Goldie's having a good year. He's hitting .298, eight homers, 32 RBIs, .358 OBP. Goldie's having a good year. I can't fathom why some of these things are happening. And then Christian Walker of the Astros is fifth in the All-Star voting at first base with a .218 batting average, 10 home runs, 37 RBIs. So Vinny Pasquantino is hitting 50 points higher than Christian Walker in terms of average. He has more home runs, more RBIs, a higher on base percentage, a higher slugging percentage, and a higher OPS. Yet Christian Walker's fifth in the All-Star voting at first base, not Vinny Pasquantino. Okay, we continue. Gleyber Torres is leading the voting in the AL at second base, as he should. I'm not going to argue that point. Jackson Holliday is in second. And not trying to disparage Jackson Holliday. He's hitting .259 this year. He's got 8 homers, 28 ribbies. But Brandon Lowe is hitting .264 with 15 homers and 42 RBIs. 7 more home runs, 14 more RBIs. He's got a better batting average, a better OBP, slugging, OPS, WAR, all of it. Brandon Lowe is in fourth place in the American League in All-Star voting for second base, behind Holliday and Jose Altuve, who is not even eligible for batting average in the American League because he's been injured. Shortstop, I'm not going to complain, right? Jacob Wilson leads the All-Star voting at shortstop right now. He's got about 240,000 more votes than Bobby Witt Jr., who's in second. Wilson's hitting .360. He's awesome. He is the no-doubt frontrunner for the American League Rookie of the Year, and he would need a cataclysmic collapse for that to not go the way it does, the way that it's going right now. Jeremy Pena in third, Bo Bichette fourth, Trey Sweeney fifth. Fine. Third base voting in the American League. Jose Ramirez in first, duh. Alex Bregman second. Alex Bregman, who hasn't played baseball in a month, is second in the American League in All-Star voting at third base. Zach McKinstry, third, who's also been injured for the Detroit Tigers. Addison Barger of the Blue Jays is in fourth. The Blue Jays have a third baseman in Ernie Clement, who's hitting .307. Primary third baseman, I guess you could say, according to ESPN. Not in the top five. Isaac Paredes is in fifth. He's got 16 home runs, 45 RBIs. He's hitting .256. Meanwhile, you've got a guy in Mikel Garcia, who is top 10 in Major League Baseball in batting average, not in the top five of the All-Star voting at his own position. What? I don't know. I can't wrap my brain around the way that some of this voting is going. I just can't. It's bad. It's bad. It's bad for the game of baseball, in my opinion. I get the fan involvement, but when you are potentially sacrificing guys who are more deserving of All-Star recognition in favor of guys who are just, oh, I know that guy's name, right? It's a popularity contest. Oh, Mookie Betts is hitting .250. He's not having the best year of his career. Oh, let's make him second in the National League and All-Star voting at shortstop. Instead of Ellie De La Cruz, who's hitting up over .270 and is on pace for a remarkable season. At some point, something's got to give, dude. Ellie's got 17 home runs, 52 RBIs. He's hitting .265, all of which are better numbers than Mookie Betts. He's got a WAR of 2.5. But Mookie has more All-Star votes than him at shortstop. In fact, almost 500,000 more votes at shortstop. Do you want to know what the fan voting does in a lot of instances? Right? There are exceptions to that. We all recall what that Royals, you know, that ever popular meme that pops up around this time every single year where every Royals starter was somehow, you know, being voted into the All-Star game. It becomes a popularity contest, and the popularity contests get dominated by the big markets. Freddie Fermin's having a solid year. for the Dodgers at first base. Pretty solid year. He's hitting 321. He's got 9 homers, 41 RBIs. Pete Alonso's hitting 290 with 18 home runs and 64 RBIs. Based on the numbers, Pete Alonso's more deserving of being the first baseman representative for the National League than Freddie Freeman. Somehow, Freddie has 500,000 more votes than Pete Alonso does. Why? I couldn't tell you. At certain positions, they've got it right. Cal Raleigh is dominating the American League catcher voting, as he should. But, I mean, like, why is Mike Trout fourth in the All-Star voting in the outfield? I love Mike Trout. Best player of the generation I grew up with watching baseball. He is not having a better year than Stephen Kwan or Kerry Carpenter or Julio Rodriguez of the Mariners. He's not. Why is he in the top four of the voting at that position? There are every single year we see this happen with players who are much more deserving of all-star recognition who don't get those opportunities. And in a sport like baseball, where the all-star voting matters, right? They don't have, they do like the all MLB stuff now, but for a long time they didn't, right? In the NFL, if a guy doesn't make the Pro Bowl, whatever, you've got the all pro voting that has much more ownership to it. When you look at a guy's resume in baseball, yes, you look at, okay, has he won a World Series? Does he have an MVP? Silver Sluggers, Gold Gloves. All-stars are a massive factor inside that and can help or hurt a guy's chances of getting into Cooperstown, which is already a near impossibility with the way that they conduct their voting. Don't even get me started on the way that they do the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. But, I mean, Brandon Lowe of the Rays is having such a good year at second base, and he has 800,000 less votes than Gleyber Torres. He's got 400,000 less votes than Jackson Holliday and almost 400,000 less votes than Jose Altuve. Big market teams can dominate this voting, and big name players can dominate this and get a much greater opportunity to become an all-star than other guys do. Right, I mean, how many people had really been focused on Brandon Lowe before this season? How many people are focused on Jonathan Aranda of the Rays? Not enough, because the Rays are a small market organization to begin with. They have, had so much trouble that they've had to overcome with the damage to their stadium in St. Petersburg, and they're having to play at the Yankees spring training facility. I don't know. You have to have a full-blown commitment from an entire fan base to make this work, or you will get smothered by big markets. New York, LA will dominate you when it comes to all-star voting. Houston, places like that. And that's what we're seeing. Mikel Garcia is in the top 10 of Major League Baseball in batting average, and he's not even in the top 5 of the voting at his position. It's a joke. It's an absolute unequivocal joke. And I'm sorry, but to make it better, I think that serious consideration should be put towards, let the fan vote be a thing, and maybe they can, I don't know, make it half of the voting. Because I know they do, the starters are voted on by the fans, and then they do, something with the commissioners and the owners and whatever to decide the reserves. But I'd say make it even less impactful to the fans than that. Be like, hey, half of the decision comes down to the fan vote, and then the other half is player voting or ownership or commissioners or whoever to decide who the roster is. So if the fans try to throw in a guy who's hitting 205 with 9 home runs into an all-star game, the league and the players and the owners can step in and be like, okay, you had your fun. Aha, funny, haha. You voted Omar Infante into the all-star game. That's not how this is going to happen. We're going to rein this one back in, because we want to put a respectable product out on the field and put the best players in baseball through the first 85 plus 90 games to represent our All-Stars in Major League Baseball.
I mean, do you remember when Zaza Pachulia kept getting voted in?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it happens, right? There's the memes every year, and it just, I don't know, man. I think it does a disservice to the game of baseball. The best players, the most deserving players, are the ones that deserve to get in. 913-586-7965 is our number. Freeman had the World Series Grand Slam. That one I can understand. Yeah, I'm not saying Freddie doesn't deserve to get into the All-Star game. That's not what I'm saying. I think that he should be the reserve first baseman for the National League in the All-Star game. He's hitting over 300. He's having a good year. But Pete Alonso has 20 more RBIs and twice as many home runs. And he's hitting nearly 300. Pete Alonso's had a much better year at the plate, top to bottom, than Freddie Freeman has. But Freddie Freeman is Freddie Freeman. So I'm not, that's maybe the one that I'm the least upset about, but I still think Pete Alonso is a guy who should be widely, widely considered to be the American League starting, or the National League, excuse me, starting first baseman. Yeah, Aaron Judge is dominating the voting in his position. Pete Crow Armstrong, Cal Raleigh. What about a guy like James Wood? I'm not hearing enough conversation about him. Don't bring up a problem without offering a solution. I just did. Make it like a half and half thing with the reserves, not the starters. Like, hey, the fans, you go ahead and do your vote. We'll take that into consideration, you know, put a formula together, and then the player voting and the ownership, the commissioner of the league, you know, the executives of the MLB, they make their recommendations. You put those two results together in some kind of a formula, and that will spit out who the reserves are. I certainly don't think the fans should be voting on who starts the All-Star game. After hours here on 96.5 The Fan, I'm going to get off my soapbox here. We're going to transition into some Kansas City Chiefs conversation here on the other side. You're listening to 96.5 The Fan.
Too often, green laundry detergents come with a compromise. They're better for the planet, but worse at the one thing that matters most: cleaning your clothes. Dirty Labs believes you shouldn't have to lower your standards for the sake of sustainability. Using advanced green chemistry, they created a detergent that uses an entirely new cleaning engine, inspired by the genius of nature. If Dirty Labs can't make you believe in the power of green cleaning, nothing will. Fall in love, or it's free, at DirtyLabs.com.
It is not hard to destroy a college. Last season, the podcast Campus Files brought you stories of fraternity drug rings, stolen body parts, campus cults, and more.
And now, Campus Files is back for another season.
There's a guy screaming into his phone. He's like, I just saw Charlie Kirk get assassinated right in front of me.
Every week is a new episode and a new story.
It was so chaotic.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Changing gears, let's talk Kansas City Chiefs football. I got a trio of stories here that I want to run down for you. The first one I got here, I saw this one earlier today from Heavy. Never heard of it. HeavySports.com. Headline reads, the Chiefs are predicted to make a rare quarterback move for the 2025 NFL season. What the hell does that mean? A rare quarterback move. Patrick Mahomes is the quarterback. Where are we going with this? The article suggests that the Kansas City Chiefs could quite possibly carry three quarterbacks on their 53-man roster during the regular season. Since Mahomes took over as the starting quarterback in Kansas City, there's only been 1 week where the Chiefs actually carried three quarterbacks on the roster. And it was while Mahomes was hurt. Last year, of course, the Chiefs had Bailey Zappe as sort of like their quasi third string quarterback behind Carson Wentz and, of course, Patrick Mahomes. And with the quarterback injuries that the Cleveland Browns experienced, they ended up picking Zappe up off of the Chiefs practice squad. And Charles Goldman of A to Z Sports has said that he thinks the Chiefs might keep Zappe and new presumed backup quarterback Gardner Minshew on the 53-man roster just in case. My response to that, no. Not only no, but hell no. For a couple of different reasons. You're going to waste a roster spot on a third quarterback? Why? You've had Chris Oladukun for a couple of seasons as a guy who's been, you know, on and off with the practice squad in Kansas City. You've got Zappe there. That's great. Yeah, a team might take a flyer on him off your practice squad if they're dealing with injuries at their position, but it's not like people are going to be clamoring for Bailey Zappe. Right, Jacob? I don't think people are going to be hooting and hollering for Bailey Zappe coming from a Patriots fan.
Yeah, it'll happen for a good 2 weeks.
You're going to waste one of only 53 spots on your roster for a position that is not of need. Secondly, I think it's just bad juju. I think it's bad karma. Three quarterbacks on your roster just feels like you're asking for your starting quarterback to go down with an injury. I just don't like the feel of it. I don't know. It gives me a bad vibe when I think about the Chiefs carrying three quarterbacks. Like what? You're preempting the possibility of a Mahomes injury? Go ahead and knock on wood if you're going to do that. That just feels like you're putting a bad aura out there. So that was kind of the first story I had. I was like, that seems sort of strange. Like, why would the Chiefs, when they, you know, could carry an extra defensive back or potentially an extra wide receiver or a linebacker as a special teams guy or a defensive lineman to give you more depth up front, you would waste that spot by just carrying a third quarterback that is in no way, shape, or form ever going to see the field? Second story I've got comes from Athlon Sports. Chris Phelps put out the announcement. This came not from Chris Phelps, but this came out on social media over the weekend. The Kansas City Chiefs announced that they have agreed to a multi-year extension to keep Chiefs training camp in St. Joseph, Missouri at Missouri Western State University. They're heading into the 15th year of training camp over in St. Joe and now have put together this multi-year extension. Training camp is expected to begin for the Chiefs on July 22nd, and it will run up through August 13th. $6 admission, of course, for the three practices that will be open to the public, or most sessions will be open and free to the public, with the three big practices with autographs and those sorts of things being $6. I'm glad to see that it's staying in the area. I wish that they would go 30 minutes north. Jacob, I'm sure you agree. Put Chiefs training camp in nice, bright, sunny, beautiful Maryville, Missouri, instead of that. No, I'm not going to say what I want to say. Instead of that, you know, ho-hum, average, run-of-the-mill location there in St. Joe and Moliste University. Oh, I'm just poking fun. Just a little MIAA rivalry. But I'm just happy to see that they're around there. Third story I've got, and this came from Jeremy Fowler of ESPN, who said earlier this week, or over the weekend on Saturday, that he got reports that the Kansas City Chiefs were actually interested, in signing Jaire Alexander after he was released by the Green Bay Packers due to a contract dispute. Alexander, of course, ultimately signed with the Baltimore Ravens. And according to Fowler, really, it was the quote unquote quick forming chemistry that he developed with the Baltimore Ravens that ultimately led to him signing there instead of maybe some other organizations in the NFL, according to him, included the Kansas City Chiefs. He said that other teams may have offered Alexander more money. It just came down to the feeling he got with Baltimore. A lot of that stems from Jair Alexander's college days playing at the University of Louisville, where he was college teammates with one Lamar Jackson. So that could certainly have something to do with it. And now the Chiefs, rather than having Jair Alexander on their roster, will line up against him in that September 14th matchup in Kansas City. 913-586-7965 is our number. Totally agree with you, especially because if Mahomes were to go down, knock on wood, their season would be over anyway. Yeah, fair. Right? Gardner Minshew would be fun to watch. He's going to make some crazy good, crazy bad plays. That's Gardner Minshew, right? He's the consummate backup quarterback. Somebody else says, especially silly. If Mahomes and Minshew both go down in a regular season game, the hope for winning that game is gone, so I'm with you. Yeah, it just doesn't. You don't need to carry three quarterbacks. I'm sorry, you don't. It just doesn't make any sense. If Mahomes goes down, the Chiefs season is, like, the ceiling for a Chiefs season kind of exudes that year Tom Brady went down for the Patriots, right? And Castle led them to like a 9-7 season, and then the Chiefs paid him like $80 million. Uh-oh, I got a Griffin grad in the text line here, Jacob. Those Mo West jokes aren't funny. And then another comment about something that Maryville has over St. Joe that I will not be repeating on the air. After hours here on 96.5 The Fan. I mentioned earlier in the show that I want to replay an interview for you guys. I had last Friday, I had Jordan Foote on with me. I had a chance to fill in for Fesco and Dusty on the morning show. And I talked with Jordan, who is a longtime reporter for the Chiefs and Royals, about the Kansas City Chiefs. Figured it was a good time here in our show tonight to replay that for you. So you'll hear from Jordan Foote coming up here on the other side of the break. After hours, Logan Weber, Jacob Mustard on 96.5 The Fan.
Too often, green laundry detergents come with a compromise. They're better for the planet, but worse at the one thing that matters most, cleaning your clothes. Dirty Labs believes you shouldn't have to lower your standards for the sake of sustainability. Using advanced green chemistry, they created a detergent that uses an entirely new cleaning engine, inspired by the genius of nature. If Dirty Labs can't make you believe in the power of green cleaning, nothing will. Fall in love, or it's free, at dirtylabs.com.
Why does it feel like nobody really gives us the inside scoop? Join us on The Powers That Be, the podcast where insiders from Puck break down who has influence, how they use it, and what it actually means for you. New episodes every weekday. Listen to The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.
After hours on 96.5 The Fan. Logan Weber here with you. Jacob Mustard is alongside producing. I got a little clip for you guys. Last Friday, I had a chance to host Fesco and Dusty. Both guys were off, so I was solo. And I had a special guest on with me, Jordan Foote, who has been a writer and reporter for the Chiefs and Royals for quite a while now. And we talked Kansas City Chiefs, the offseason, Travis Kelce, the offense, and so much more as we are a month away now from the start of training camp and just a couple of months away from the start of the NFL season. Mandatory mini camp for the Chiefs has now concluded as we all kind of set our sights now to training camp itself. But we had a couple of big stories come out of mini camp yesterday. Andy Reid at the podium speaking with the media and first mentions that Rashee Rice is expected to be a full go for training camp. Not that that was much of a surprise for people, but you know, what do you make of Rashee being able to go for training camp? What does that mean for him this season? And what should the expectation be for Rashee Rice with the Kansas City Chiefs this year via the fan base?
Man, it's absolutely huge for Rashee Rice. And this is a player that I think some of the discourse with him has been surrounded whether the league's going to, you know, take action and if he's going to miss time because of that. And I truly believe, and that seems to be the consistent reporting, that once that whole process legally wraps up, then they'll cross that bridge. So it is pretty purely a health standpoint for his availability to start the year. And hopefully if you're the Chiefs, finish the year. The LCL injury, like that was a weird, the posterior lateral corner, the hit from Patrick Mahomes to friendly fire, the timing of the season, it made Travis Kelce much more important to the offense. Like it had a huge ripple effect. And I think his return is going to have the same thing. It's going to open things up for Travis Kelce on early downs. It's going to make him more viable, more fresh on late downs. It will make Patrick Mahomes' life easier. This is a player, Logan, that had 29 targets in less than four full games, because that hit in the Chargers game happened fairly early. So he was pacing for well over 1,000 yards. He was going to go over 10 touchdowns, way over 100 targets, probably hit 100-plus receptions. He was going to be the number one target in the Chiefs offense. And you combine that with Hollywood Brown being healthy and hopefully looking to bounce back after a rough and very abbreviated 2024. Xavier Worthy, who came on strong down the stretch of the season, he's going to be the number one guy, I think, statistically in the pecking order, in the progressions. He can do everything they want. He's a threat from short range. He can run those mesh concepts over the middle. He showed a little bit of the ability to threaten deep down the field. Not to get too ahead of myself here, but I do think that there's no player returning outside of, you know, a Patrick Mahomes or maybe a Chris Jones on the defensive side who means more to this team right now than a guy like Rashee Rice.
So I'm, you know, talking about all that, I'm curious, you mentioned the pace that he was on last year. And I'm curious, from your standpoint, after hearing comments from Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes about how good he's looked, is it more likely that we see that a return to that form for Rashee Rice this year? Or could we see some, you know, bumps along the path here as he tries to get himself back into that kind of shape and production level after the injury?
For a player who relies on that quick twitch yards after catch ability, and I mean, it's different. It's like the Tyreek Hill versus Mecole Hardman debate, or even Xavier Worthy. You line those guys up and say race 100 yards down the field, the gap probably isn't that crazy. But if you say run 10 yards down the field, prime Tyreek Hill is going to beat almost anybody on the face of the earth because he accelerates so quick. Rashee Rice, for his athletic profile, is kind of like that, where he gets the ball and immediately can turn upfield and get going. Very reliant on the side-to-side, the agility, the durability in that knee is going to be tested. So I don't want to say that it's a foregone conclusion. He'll be back, and I've heard a lot of people talking about how players go up in training camp and they say, you know, Juan Thornhill is a good example. I feel like I'm 100% back. Then the following year they say, well, you know, I wasn't exactly 100%. I felt like I was, but now I fully am. So I'm kind of splitting the difference here. Rashee Rice, as a rookie, averaged 59 yards a game receiving. Last year, on his torrid pace, he was averaging 72, and that would have been higher had he finished the Chargers game. You factor in what could be a last hurrah for Travis Kelce. You factor in the growth of Xavier Worthy. Juju being in the mix, Hollywood being in the mix, whatever Jalen Royals can get you. Let's say he only averages, and I put only in air quotes, 65 yards a game and plays all 17 games. That's 1,105 yards. That is still a very strong season. He'd probably lead the team in receiving at that point. Rashee Rice, I think a reasonable expectation for him, even if he isn't 100%, is to play all year and flirt with 1,000 yards. And if that's the case, then the Chiefs offense should be more explosive, more efficient, and more dangerous heading into what we assume is going to be a playoff run.
And then you had the other storyline via Andy Reid yesterday at minicamp, and that was that Josh Simmons is expected to be no holds barred for training camp as well. And that news comes a couple of weeks after, you know, Adam Tyker of ESPN reports that some people in and around the Chiefs facility believe or have said that he's going to be the starter week one for this Chiefs team. Now, of course, nobody with the Chiefs has confirmed that one way or another, but, you know, I'm just curious from your standpoint, have you heard anything, and what do you think the expectation is for Josh Simmons, and how important is it for him to be a full participant and ready to go for training camp coming up here in a little over a month?
Similar to Rice, Logan, it's a tremendous sign for a guy who suffered a pretty serious knee injury. And now we've heard the speculation that it was that partial tear in the, you know, patellar tendon. That is a very, very tough, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Lucas Niang who dealt with something similar, and that kind of derailed His progression early in his career, he's a very good athlete. Simmons is. He's very structurally sound. Like, if that knee bounces back, no first round tackle is a safe bet to pan out, but he was going to be a top 10 player. Like, the talent is not a question. The fit in Kansas City is not a question. The ceiling is not a question. I think that the character concerns and, like, does he love football? All of that was very overblown and could have even been some smoke from teams to maybe get him to drop down the board a little bit, as we do every draft season. Jalen Moore is a viable option. Now, I'm not as high on him as many other people. I think the Chiefs kind of showed with his contract that they don't know whether he's a long-term answer or a stopgap or a really, really good swing tackle or a low-end backup or maybe a right tackle, or can you get us by in a pinch at left tackle? Like, he gives them options. And next year, assuming the team moves on from Jawan Taylor, gives them an option there. But the Chiefs have been very, very stern about Simmons as a left tackle, and he seems to be their left tackle. They have been a lot more heaping with praise and acknowledgement than I thought they would be. Every time you think, okay, there's a, let's say, 30% chance he's going to be the week one starter, and that's on May 1st. Every week it seems to trickle up a little bit more. And then Mitchell Schwartz is out there, and you're learning about how he's getting mentored and how Andy Reid is, you know, taking a liking to him and tutoring him. And I'd say now it's, if not 50-50, maybe even trending upward in the other direction. And it's insane that his ascension is happening so quick, and we haven't even got to training camp, where I think if Moore's still dealing with a nagging injury or something, then the rookie could truly stand out from the pack.
It's always a dart on the wall when you're speaking in hypotheticals, but that's kind of the world that we live in here in sports media. So I want to run a scenario by you. Josh Simmons is named as the Chiefs starter week one against the Chargers, right? And the struggles begin, right? You have the growing pains of being a rookie in this league. Do you see the Kansas City Chiefs handling Josh Simmons and his situation, if it comes to pass, differently than the way that Kingsley Suamataia's situation was handled last year, where he struggled, only started two games, and then the carousel began at left tackle? Do you think that they'll stick with him a little bit more or completely versus the way that they did with Suamataia last season?
Yes, and it's ironic because last year they didn't have nearly as good of a backup plan at left tackle. Like, if you're going to make that pivot early in the year, this would be the time to do it. But I do think that Wanya Morris being injured kind of threw a fork in their plans, and Kingsley wasn't, and pretty obviously on the field, wasn't as ready as they thought he could be. And that whole thing was just weird because all offseason everyone was in agreement. He's a very unnatural immediate fit for the NFL. BYU just didn't run a ton of traditional pass sets that the NFL does. It was going to take him time to develop and get that foot speed going, learn how to mirror at the NFL level, learn how to, you know, adopt the sets the Chiefs have. Then when he looked very, very out of place and looked like a rookie who needed time, they had to make a pivot. Now, if Josh Simmons looks, let's say, underwhelming, he doesn't even have to be getting beat like a drum by Trey Hendrickson, or even week two against the Eagles, one of their talented pass rushers, or week one against the Chargers. I think it's the Giants week three could be a little bit of a break, but then you're back and you're playing Baltimore at home. Like, he's going to be tested in that first month of the season, of course, if he is the starter to begin the year. I think they will give him a little bit longer of a leash, and I think that they're also banking on him not being as bad to start the year. And if he is the week one starter, assuming that Jalen Moore is mostly healthy, then it's, instead of an indictment on the competition, it's more of a testament to how good the prospect really is.
So let's change gears a little bit. Talking about the media availability yesterday, Travis Kelce made some pointed comments about the offseason, you know, the retirement rumors and all those things. And he said that it wasn't really a difficult choice for him. I mean, curious from your standpoint, you know, are you surprised that Trav said, you know, this is something that I didn't really think about a whole lot. It wasn't a tough choice. I was coming back, you know, considering how long the decision took, and the fact that the Chiefs and Brett Veach had to kind of push back his timetable to allow him to have a little bit more time to come to that decision. Does it surprise you for him to say, no, I was coming back?
A little bit. And you hit the nail on the head. Like, that roster bonus deadline, I think it was like March 4th or 14th. It was one of those two of like $11.5 million, screamed, okay, dude, if you're not coming back, you know, let's get this show on the road and let's get this, you know, contractually figured out. This is the last year of his deal. It was renegotiated to set up to be the last year of his deal. He has a roster bonus on the fifth day of training camp that I think is for another $1 million. He's getting compensated fairly at last, at long last, for what he's capable of doing and what really he has done over the years. If there's one thing I've learned, though, it's that Travis Kelce is going to have a different answer about retirement every single time he talks, because he has gone through, I think about it more than anybody else. It's constantly on my mind. I've been banged up to, I don't think about it at all, to asking the media, you don't think about retirement, guys? Like, is it natural to do that? To saying he hopes he's with the Chiefs for multiple seasons in a row, to, okay, this could be it, to, okay, maybe I come back after this and we get another contract going. Like, I think he's kind of playing that game a little bit, and rightfully so. It's not his obligation to be completely upfront about the timeline, and I do think that there was at least a conversation or a series of them had over the offseason, but the way he's going about it now doesn't surprise me a ton. However, it is at least interesting that he's not being upfront about it being it, and we've kind of grown to assume it, whereas there is a non-zero chance that if this year goes fairly well and he doesn't want to go out on top, that, you know, maybe he does want to come back for another year.
He also confirmed that he has lost some weight since last season. Now, some people were reporting that it was like 25 pounds. I don't know what the exact weight that he lost was, but he did confirm that he had lost weight. So what is a reasonable expectation in your view for Travis Kelce this year from a production standpoint and what he can provide this team, that keeping in mind that, you know, Rashee Rice and Xavier Worthy and Hollywood Brown can stay healthy over the course of these 18 weeks?
It is interesting because last year you saw the volume go up. He was targeted more than the previous season. He had more receptions than the previous season, but he only had 3 touchdowns, and the yards per reception dropped precipitously. It went from 12.2 in 2022 to 10.6 in 23 and then 8.5 last year. I think the volume in terms of targets and receptions will obviously go down. He won't have 133 targets, and that's the right way to do it. He should not have 133 targets. He should not have 97 receptions. So let's say he has 85 and he bounces back up to 10.6 or even 10. You're looking at another 850, 900-yard season. I'd expect more than 3 touchdowns, probably 5, 6, maybe even 7. It will be not necessarily, you'll look at the stat line and say, okay, he didn't get much worse, he didn't get much better. But I think the efficiency stats, the catch rate, the success rate, the third down stats, the depth of target, the yards per reception, all of the peripherals and the tape, probably because he'll be fresher, will look better. And it's tough to predict because he's going to be, what, 36 years old, deep into this run here in October. It is very reasonable to say, okay, if this was any other 35-year-old tight end in year 13, we'd say he's due for another drop-off. He's due for one more step down the rung. Then you're looking at something different. But I really do believe that he'll maintain what he was doing last season, and then probably and hopefully, if you're the Chiefs, be a little bit more efficient while doing it.
Well, I was hoping to maybe get a little bit of an opportunity here to talk either NBA Finals Game 7 or Jack Caglione. We're running a little bit short on time, so I'll give you a little bit of time to maybe give us your reaction to Jack Caglione getting his first 2 big league moonshots yesterday against the Rangers.
They were both overdue, and not necessarily in the same game like it happened, but very happy for him that it did. The expected stats were there. He's hitting the cover off the ball. If you're a baseball savant nerd, you could go on that page, and it was a lot of red. And sure, he's chasing. The swing decisions aren't great. He's getting the ball in the air to the pole side less than people expected, but then he comes up and hits two mammoth crazy home runs yesterday. So overdue, not worried about him the slightest, and definitely one of the cooler moments in what's been a up and down season for the Royals so far.
That was Jordan Foote, longtime reporter for both the Chiefs and Royals, joining us. That was an interview from last Friday that I did while I was on Fesco and Dusty. Thought it would be nice to replay it for you guys here tonight. We're going to take a break. It'll be a longer break, and we'll get you guys set to go for the 8 o'clock hour here on After Hours on 96.5 The Fan. Logan Weber alongside Jacob Mustard, your home for Kansas City sports.
You read labels on your food because what's in it matters. Dirty Labs brings that same thinking to your dishes. In other words, what touches your food matters too. Dirty Labs is proving that cleaning doesn't have to be so dirty. So they created a dishwasher detergent designed to deliver conventional levels of clean without the toxic chemicals or residue. Because the plates and forks your family eats from deserve the same care as the food you put on them. Fall in love, or it's free, at DirtyLabs.com.
When the stakes rise and the lights get bright, that's when you find out who can really swim. Deep Waters is a new UFC podcast from CBS Sports. Every Monday, myself, Dean Thomas, alongside with legends of the sport, Chris Weidman, Jorge Masvidal, and Dustin Poirier, bring you inside the octagon like no one else can. Deep Waters, new episodes every Monday. Watch on YouTube or listen on Apple, Spotify, and everywhere else you get podcasts.